This is a special edition of Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the premier financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Now, for this special edition of Macro Voices, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Macro Voices Energy Week, episode number 5, was recorded on Wednesday, June 5th, 2019. I'm Eric Townsend. I'll be joined this week by author and consultant Anas Alhaji, petroleum geologist Art Berman, and professional crude oil trader Tracy Shuchart. Topics for this episode include an update on the developing downtrend in energy prices and a deeper look at Venezuela, Iran, and Saudi Arabia. But first, let's dive right into the EIA data. Crude oil building a massive 6.7 million barrels on inventory this week, Cushing, Oklahoma, another massive 1.8 million barrels. It doesn't end there, though, folks. Gasoline building massively, 3.2 million barrels, and distillates really knocking the ball out of the park, building 4.6 million barrels. Now, that by itself was enough to send the tape action not just down, but panic down in both RBOB gasoline and the crudes. But wait, there's more. U.S. production moving to a new all-time high of 12.4 million barrels. Remember all that talk a few weeks ago about how it was going to reverse and the rig count was telling us and the blah, blah, blah? Well, it's not reversing yet, folks. Now, of course, EIA only updates their production to the nearest 100,000 barrels. That's something I'm going to be asking Anas about in the beginning of this interview, is the quality of that data. But clearly, we don't have a downtrend in play, as some people were fearing. Imports, 7.9 million barrels. Exports, 3.3 million barrels per day. That's 23 million barrels of U.S. oil exported on the week. And even after exporting that 23 million barrels, there's still 6.7 million extra barrels in inventory this week. So needless to say, the downside price action comes as no surprise. Now let's meet this week's expert panel. Dr. Anas Alhaji is an author, keynote speaker, and energy markets expert. He was formerly the chief economist for NGP Energy Capital Management and also taught energy economics at the University of Oklahoma and the Colorado School of Mines. Anas, I hope you had a fantastic trip to China last week. Now that you're back this week, I want to get your perspective on data quality in energy markets. I know that's a subject that you have some passion for.
Absolutely. I had a great trip, and I did talk about the impact of exchange rates on the oil industry and pricing oil in yuan and versus the dollar. Anyway, back to data quality. Social media, information technology, the efforts by companies to reduce cost of reports, deadlines to report data, lack of auditing of IEA, OPEC, and EIA data are all corrupting the quality of the data and information. Regardless of those issues, data quality deteriorated significantly in recent months. Let us start with OPEC and OPEC Plus. For example, some OPEC members are not reporting their production data at all. Some members are reporting virtually the same production number every month, month after month. Some members being added to OPEC, but they never dealt with data before. The same thing applies for OPEC Plus. So we have some serious problems there. Now with sanctions on Iran and Venezuela and the growing black market, or as the Iranians call it, the gray market, the situation got worse and worse by the day. Looking at China, for example, we have to calculate the implied demand since data is not available or not provided. We do not have accurate information about storage and specifically the strategic petroleum reserves. And therefore, the implied demand calculation could be completely off. So it could be wrong. Now, the big elephant in the room. Turning to the EIA, the quality of the data deteriorated significantly since August last year. The growing adjustment factor, the benchmarking, the rounding of production numbers to the nearest 100,000, they all point to a deteriorating data quality on one hand, and they also make the situation worse on the other. The mismatch between the weekly data and the monthly data is evidence of that. The mismatch between the monthly data and the data in the drilling productivity report is evidence of that. The fact that condensates from oil wells are counted as crude, while they are not counted that way by the oil companies and by the rest of the world, is making the situation worse. So the fact that large amount of taxpayer money is spent by the EIA on modeling, then resorting to benchmarking and rounding is ridiculous. Just does not make sense. They have enough money to do very well on these things. Data examination showed that the U.S. oil crude production, the U.S. crude oil production, has been virtually flat in recent months, while the EIA continued to show increase in weekly data. And here is another factor, Eric, that's kind of very interesting. The entry of media companies into ship tracking is making the situation worse. The reason, because they mostly report on electronic monitoring and what is it showing. They cannot see the oil tankers that turned off their transporters, for example. Yet, because they are media companies, they are able to transmit their information and their own data to a wider audience worldwide. Social media itself is contributing to the worsening of data quality. For example, circular information. The same information is repeated by numerous number of people or media outlets until people believe it's reality, while it all belongs to one source. All of us remember, and Tracy in particular probably remember this, when they talked about the gold-backed UN oil contract. I mean, this went viral, and it was one source, and it was wrong. Some sources of the problems where data is getting worse, basically, is data entry itself. Data entry is left to the least experienced people in the organization, and if they enter the data in the wrong column or the wrong cell, then the analysts won't know, and they will base their analysis based on the wrong data. In fact, if we've got to go back to the databases of the EIA, we have examples of that. Use of previous templates, another problem. Some people use the same template month after month, and they overlook the changes to match the new data. If you look at the Texas Railroad Commission, for example, we have many examples of that. And then the media is picking up of those templates and picking up the wrong information. Mandatory data submission basically is causing problem because people have to submit data by the deadline, and there is no punishment for submitting the wrong data because you can always revise. In a sense, auditing becomes very important in this process. The final point is for analysts, oil analysts, as if dealing with multiple factors and multiple layers affecting oil prices is not enough. Worsening data quality is adding insult to injury here. And I think in this program, our job basically is to add clarity and clarify these issues.
Well, Anis, it's great to have you back from China and bringing clarity to these issues. Tracy Shuchart is a professional crude oil futures trader who worked on the floor of the exchange in Chicago before moving on to become a full-time futures trader. Tracy, you just penned an article in your blog at chigirl.com. That's chigrl.com, explaining the basics of contango and backwardation in crude oil markets. And that post is getting thousands of views. It's just remarkable to me how many hits you're getting on that article. But while those terms describe relationships in time spreads within a single market, that is intra-market spreads, I know that you, in your own trading, actively trade the intermarket spreads as well, particularly the Brent WTI spread. So please give us the lowdown. As a professional crude oil trader, why do you think that the spread trade, the Brent WTI spread, is the place to be trading right now? And which side of that trade are you on and why?
Again, we'll take each curve. We'll just briefly go over each curve right now. And so first we'll take the Brent spread. And so what is accounting for the propped curve? We're in backwardation and front end is very steep in backwardation. So why is this happening? First, we have Venezuela sanctions. We have exports sank another 17% this last month. We had Russian crude production was down due to the Urals contamination issue. They're saying there's different estimates, obviously, but you know, I've seen as low as 10.2 million barrels per day. That's down significantly. We have Iran sanctions, obviously, that's taken 1.5 million barrels, give or take, off the market. We have OPEC cuts. And then finally, we had the threat of Mexican tariffs. Now, we don't know whether that includes energy or not, but the market definitely reacted. The spread reacted. On the WTI side, what we have is we have the front end in contango. Why is this happening? Well, we have global growth slowdown, persistent theme. We have stockpiles in the U.S. have risen by 35 million barrels since the start of the year. That's about 9.7% above a year ago. U.S. crude production is at an all-time high. We've surpassed Russia and Saudi Arabia. And total U.S. products consumed are on the decline. So we're seeing the front end of this curve in contango. So taking these two pieces of information separately and putting them together, what I'm looking at is short WTI, long Brent spread. And I've actually been talking about this trade. But since the beginning of April, we're already, that spread's already widened by $5. We were at, just for example, take the NN spread, the July spread. We started at $6 about and we're at $11. So that spread is widening. Only think that this spread will get wider. And I remember back in February, I kept talking about this spread saying that we were going to see double digits. And everybody said that I was crazy. But here we are in double digits. So, but I do think, and I'll touch upon this in the next section, why I think this spread's even going to get wider.
Fantastic. Well, it's great to have you back on the panel, Tracy. Art Berman is a petroleum geologist who spends most of his time drilling oil wells, but he's also become a favorite keynote speaker and consultant to investors. Art put together a slide deck for today's show. You can download that from our homepage at macrovoices.com. Art, my question for you, which needless to say, we coordinated off the air, and that's why you've got a slide deck for it, is what do U.S. refined product consumption and storage tell us about why markets are negative on oil prices?
Well, I'm really glad you asked that question, Eric, since I helped you form it. Yeah, I think that the market is a little bit confused at the moment, or to state it more clearly, some of the analysts are confused about the market. And so there's this focus on supply and the issues that Tracy just talked about with, you know, tightness on the heavier grades, all correct and all for good reason. But what I think is being certainly not missed, but perhaps underemphasized, is when we look at storage or inventories, I mean, crude oil is a big deal, but it's less than half of U.S. inventories. So we have to look at the other side. We have to look at the refined products. And when we do that, as Tracy also just mentioned, if you look at my slide too, what we're seeing in the last couple of months is both a real decline in product supplied, which is a proxy for consumption, year over year, and also compared to the five-year average. So basically, consumption of U.S. refined products peaked in late summer in August, and we've gotten down year over year to the most negative growth since back in the early part of 2017 when we were still trying to dig our way out of the oil price collapse. So, you know, we get focused on whatever we're focused on, but clearly demand is part of the equation, as important in many ways as supply. It does tend to change more slowly, but when it happens, and it's happening now, it happens in a big way. So that's the basic background that I think is important to be able to understand what's happening. And so if we move on then to slide number three, and let me just say, it's absolutely true that supply is tight, and it's also true that supply is tightening. The problem is that demand is declining pretty much in tandem with supply, and that gets you to a place that isn't very good when you're looking, you know, at the total picture of pricing. So the slide that I'm showing in three is comparative inventory, and this is just the way that I take a simple look at what's happening. And what you can see are really two things here, and that is that comparative inventory, which is just inventory compared to the five-year average, has been increasing steadily since the early part of the year. And that's not a good thing if you like higher oil prices. It's a great thing if you like lower ones, and the consumers generally do. But two things I'd like to point out. The first is that this is a counter-inventory price increase, which means that much of this price increase has been occurring when storage is higher than the five-year average. Okay, anything can happen, but that's not supposed to happen. It's happening because of sentiment. It's happening because of the tightness of supply, the dichotomy between Brent and WTI, all good reasons. I'm not saying that it's false. I'm just saying that when sentiment pushes up the price this much, as soon as bad news comes along, the tendency is to crash it. Now, the other thing is people always think that prices are too low whenever they drop. And this graph shows that, in fact, looking at comparative inventory as of this week, May 31st data, we go back to the last time we saw that level, which was in January. And in fact, today's front month price of about 51 is actually a little bit higher than it was in January, which was 50. So, you know, price is right. The final points I want to make is just that you really need to look at crude and refined products separately before you integrate them. And so this slide, number four, shows this. It's the same kind of display of comparative inventory, but it shows when you look at crude supply, what it shows is that crude supply started climbing back towards the beginning of the year. Whereas in the next slide, which is just product, we see that product was still decreasing comparative inventory for some time while crude stocks were building. What does that mean? That means that refiners were still getting good high prices for their products, and so they were destocking. Okay, so that gave everybody the sense that, oh, good, you know, storage is going down. As soon as that end user demand started running up against a wall here in the last 3 months, that destocking ended. And of course, today we saw a huge jump in both crude oil and refined product inventories, and the market reacted accordingly. So that's why I think that the markets are basically collapsing and are fairly negative, despite all the good reasons that oil prices could be higher.
Well, Art, thanks so much for that update. Just for our listeners who may not be familiar with the comparative inventory method of analyzing oil prices, just put Art Berman's name into the search box at macrovoices.com. We've discussed comparative inventory at considerable length in some of Art's earlier interviews on the Macro Voices podcast. Listeners, we'll be diving into our first discussion topic, the big sentiment change in markets, right after this. For our first major discussion topic this week, we're going to examine the big change in sentiment in energy markets over the last 2 weeks. Just a few weeks ago, all the talk was about how long it would take to get back to $80 Brent, but now suddenly credible analysts are talking about how long it will take to get back down into the 40s. Inventory data certainly helped get this going, and the China trade negotiations helped as well. But crude oil and the S&P 500 stock index were trading almost in lockstep when the China situation pulled both markets lower. On Tuesday of this week, the S&P rallied hard and closed above the psychologically important 2800 level. But crude oil was flat on the day and then spiked lower when API reported an inventory build, even as stocks continued to recover. Then, Wednesday, EIA confirmed an even bigger inventory build, and crude oil dropped like a rock, even as stocks continued to rally, not quite as aggressively as Tuesday, but stocks up, crude oil down, so we can no longer say this is just sympathy with the stock market. So what's really going on here, and where is it headed? Art Berman, let's start with you, since we just left off with you on comparative inventory. You talked a little bit about some of the factors driving it. Where are we headed from here?
For now, Eric, we're headed down. The sentiment is clearly reversed, as you just said. And the fundamentals, I think, when you weigh them in a balance, I have to say that the negatives outweigh the positives. Positive being higher price, tighter supply. Negative being lower price and more supply. Now, it's fascinating to me that every time I post a forecast by OPEC or IEA or EIA, there are lots of boos and hisses out there. Everybody says, oh, that's bogus. You know, you can't, you know, they're always wrong. Well, fair enough. All forecasts are wrong. But that's pretty much what, you know, what those data have been telling me for a month or so. Look out once we get past the first quarter. And so that seems to be what we're seeing. So today's news was terrible for oil prices. I mean, it was much worse than I expected. The other factor I'll throw in there is that if you look at US GDP, it's down. I didn't show a slide of that because it's too depressing. But any way you look at this, I mean, we talk in generalities about how the global economy is getting weaker. Unfortunately, we don't have the granularity of data on the global economy that we do on the U.S. when it comes to oil. And the indicators from the oil data are something's going to have to change. And we like to hope, you know, summer driving, consumption will increase, certainly possible. And I'll just close this answer by saying, for as negative as consumption information goes, we're still above the five-year average. So it's relatively lower, it's weaker. But, you know, it's not as if we've dropped off a cliff.
Thanks, Art. Tracy Shuchart, how low can we go here?
Okay. So in order for this market to bounce, we need to really start seeing some draws in the U.S., some firming of some global data. Otherwise, you know, just as Art said, the trajectory pretty much remains weak in the near term. That said, I want to also mention, I want to bring up IMO 2020 going into the third quarter. Because of expensive upgrading and hydro treating processes, shippers will probably start using marine gas oil to satisfy IMO requirements. And higher demand for gas oil will have to be met with higher crude runs, thus putting upward pressure on global crude prices and distillate premiums to other fuels. This switch should add about 1.5 million barrels per day to distillate demand globally, leading refiners to run an additional 2.2 million barrels per day of crude through distillation. That's a massive increase in demand. I think that this will also lead to light heavy differential spike. Again, another reason I still like the short WTI long Brent spread into the third quarter.
Okay. Thanks, Tracy. And, you know, I'm very much myself in the same camp as you and Art. I think that unless there is a change in the data, that we're probably headed into the 40s from here. Anas, how about a bullish perspective to counter us grumpy bears?
Oh, absolutely. And you just said bullish data. And I spent a few minutes talking about how bad the data is. So here is the issue. If you look at the data released today, we have increase in imports by more than 1 million barrels a day. But this fits the historical pattern of increased imports in the last week of May. So it's not really that bearish. It just, that's what the trend is for the last week. And looking at the sources of that imports, it is very, very clear that it is about crude quality that Tracy alluded to. But if you look deeper at the data, you look at the consumption, consumption declined by more than 2 million barrels a day. I mean, that's what really the source of the build is. You have increased imports and you have decreasing consumption. The problem is the EIA has this habit of always reducing consumption by 2 million barrels a day the week after Memorial Day. And then consumption picks up again. So whether you look at the import data or you look at the consumption data, we are talking about 3 million barrels a day here. So I think this is very bullish the way it looks like right now. We are going to see going forward, we're going to see lower imports, higher consumption, higher refinery utilization, and exports will remain high. The Saudis and others basically are going to continue their low exports to the United States. But please let me go back to the initial question. about the sentiment and the change in the sentiment in the last 2 weeks. As you all know, along with my followers on Twitter, I was very critical of those who were promoting the idea of extremely tight physical market. It just did not make sense. And they were extremely tight simply because they said, because we have a contango. But reasons for the contango are more important than the impact of the contango itself. Here is the problem. Consulting houses, or some consulting houses, were warning of a very tight physical market. Speculators and investors, traders, went very long expecting a price spike. But physical tightness came from storage hoarding, not from consumption. And I know Art mentioned the weak consumption earlier, so he's right on that. So the tightness came in from storage hoarding, and that includes China, of course. And the market was not actually as tight. Tightness was actually a disappointment to the expectations, so prices sold off. This, along with macro concerns, of course, led to more people selling. So the tightness wasn't as tight, and the spreads, while tight, was less tight than what people had expected, given commentaries from the consulting houses. In other words, many people fell into the trap of storage versus consumption. And the final issue here is why we ended up with storage hoarding. Of course, we know in Asia, in China in particular, because of the Iran sanctions, but in the US because of crude quality. So as a result, we ended up with financials having to liquidate and blame the consulting houses for fooling investors twice.
I agree, Anas, with what you said. However, I do take a little bit of issue with some of the seasonal arguments you're making, and I can only speak for myself, but this is the reason that I rely so heavily on 5-year averages, because and I don't just do that with inventories. I do it with imports, I do it with consumption, I do it with all these kinds of things. And that's because it normalizes out those seasonal variations. So, you know, that's really point number one. The other thing, though, that I completely understand and agree with about data quality, I mean, this issue of unaccounted for oil that comes up, you know, every week with EIA reporting. I mean, 6 million barrels of crude oil in today's report was unaccounted for oil. So, you know, we can have another discussion about, you know, what that means. I don't think, and I don't believe you think either, that this is just a fudge factor that EIA throws in to confound us all. But there is plenty of uncertainty. And that's the other reason why most of what I talk about, and I think, you know, most credible analysts talk about, is we're going to go to the monthly revised data as a primary source and only rely on the weekly data. And then it's averaged over a month when we run out of the monthly data. So I'm not disputing your points. I'm just saying that there are some partial remedies.
Personally, basically, this 5-year average is good for theory, but if you want to trade tomorrow, you cannot trade on 5-year averages. And that's the only comment I have.
Okay, and with that, we will be back with our second topic right after this. Our next discussion topic will be to take a closer look at both Saudi Arabia, Iran, and Venezuela, three countries which are critically important to energy markets for different reasons. All three countries have had disagreements with the Trump administration, and the question of how much power they each have and what options are actually open to them isn't always clear to market participants. Dr. Anas Al-Haji, I'd like you to comment on Saudi Arabia in particular. We know President Trump's position from his Twitter feed, but I often wonder how the U.S. messaging is received by the Saudis and what range of options they actually have available to them as we consider the various possible outcomes, let's say, of the U.S.-Iranian conflict.
Well, generally speaking, when President Trump tweeted the first tweet, I mean, everyone was in complete shock, because no one expected that. But it is very clear from the Saudi policy that they ignored President Trump. And here is why. As a general rule, countries in the region learned a very important lesson from the Iranian Revolution in 1979. What is that lesson? The lesson is domestic pressure ousted the Shah despite the international support for the Shah. So therefore, they are more worried at certain points that domestic pressure is going to be so high. So they are willing to sacrifice the international pressure in this case. So they are going to yield to the domestic pressure. In Saudi Arabia, they need to walk a thin line between domestic pressure and international pressure. They need the money. Most of the population are youth. They need jobs. They are still in stages of economic development. They have the vision of 2030. They need money to spend on to make it happen. So they, under that domestic pressure, they have to ignore President Trump. On the other side, and to go with the bearish thesis that we heard about before, all this talk about major decline in Iran and Venezuela exports, in my view, is not correct. And I think I have enough evidence to prove my point that Iran is still exporting larger amounts of oil than what's reported by anyone else. And there are many methods to do so. Those guys being under embargoes for over 30 years, and they perfected working under embargoes. They already created underground systems in this gray market that they labeled as gray, with the cooperation of other countries that appear to kind of yield to President Trump demand and to U.S. sanctions. For example, just quickly to say this, while Korea said they don't import anything from Iran, it was Korean ships that just took 4 million barrels out of Iran last week. So the idea here is, why Saudi Arabia, going back to Saudi Arabia, why Saudi Arabia has to compensate based on Pompeo's request and Trump's request for the loss of Iranian and Venezuelan crude, while we don't have actually that loss. On the other side, Asian countries in particular, they did buy large amount of oil from Iran and others, as I mentioned earlier, and they put it in strategic petroleum reserves to be used later. And we already seen China destock last year. So why Saudis have to yield to that, increase exports, only to repeat what happened last year? So I think they learned a very important lesson last year, and it's I think they are following their best interest in this case. The other issue that I would like to emphasize here is they are literally interested in market stability. I know some people, especially people on the macroeconomic side, they laugh at a statement like this. But no one realizes the impact of market stability like the Saudis. We are not talking about stability like prices within a very tight range. We are just talking about avoiding extreme volatility. Extreme volatility hurt the Saudis economically and politically. So they are really interested in reducing that extreme volatility.
Art Berman, you spend a lot of your time working with the guys that are actually drilling oil wells in the Permian and elsewhere in the United States. I know that a lot of Wall Street analysts don't seem to understand that crude quality matters, but I know those guys do. So they've got to be talking about the risk of there being some kind of a heavy blend stock shortage. A lot of that heavy blend stock comes from Iran and Venezuela, and well, it's not coming from there anymore. Is there a concern that blend stock could be a major risk for the producers in the shale patch in the United States? And what are your other thoughts on this topic generally?
Well, that's an important question, Eric. And the answer is, first of all, I don't know. But I'm pretty strongly believing that, I mean, the guys that run these tight oil companies, I mean, these are smart, sophisticated people. You know, we can talk about the ethics of some of their business models as another topic. But, I mean, they're not dumb, and they're well aware of what the issues are. I worry more, back to Anas's point about data quality from the big agencies. I'm not really sure that they fully grasp how important this is, because they, you know, IEA particularly tends to talk about all oil as if it's the same, whether it's, you know, biofuels or heavy or light or oxygenated fuel oils or whatever, and it's just not. But But to get down to the core of your problem that you raise, Eric, you know, the Permian Basin and the tight oil patch is acting right now like there's just no problem, man. When prices collapsed back in October, production declined or flattened, and it stayed that way for a couple of months. But if you look at my slide 6 in the deck that I provided, since January, it's been up, up, and up. So we hear a lot about restraint, fiscal restraint, living out of cash flow, et cetera, et cetera. And I know they're listening. I mean, they're not ignoring that. But the production data says otherwise. I mean, we've increased tight oil production 278,000 barrels a day from February to May. That's a pretty big increase. So back to some of Tracy's points, this doesn't solve anything except it sort of adds accelerant to the problem of the Brent WTI spread. So I think we've got some big issues to, you know, a day of reckoning is on the horizon somewhere.
Tracy Shuchart, Iran, Venezuela, Saudi Arabia. Where do we start?
Well, first of all, let's take Venezuela. Right now, really, you know, what traders are watching, what we're watching is obviously the situation with Maduro. There's been a lot of rumors. He's running out of money. Russia may or may not be removing their troops and removing help from Venezuela. So we're all kind of watching, you know, because if this regime does fall, if the Maduro regime does fall, then although it would take a significant amount of time to, you know, ramp up production for Venezuela, it's not like turning on a switch, the market will likely see this as positive and react immediately. So that's one thing to be watching, is kind of, you know, what is happening politically within Venezuela. So I think if we take like Saudi Arabia and Iran, that I think the Saudis are keeping a closer watch on Iran than the U.S. is, because they're convinced that the zero exports aren't working. And obviously, for all the reasons Anna said, they're not, you know, we've discussed this before. So I think that what Saudi Arabia was trying to do is they were shipping less to the United States, kind of in hopes of suppressing EIA inventory data. But that's not really working, because refineries are lacking heavier crude. Venezuelan heavy crude is gone. We've increased a little bit from Canada, but again, we have a transportation problem there. So, you know, runs are down. We should be well over, you know, 17 million barrels per day right now, but we're not. So that kind of plan is backfiring. On the back end, Saudi Arabia is upping its exports to China as an alternative to the U.S., because they're not really, they're not an OECD member state, so they don't get really factored into inventories for the same reasons that Anas was talking about. They're also raising prices to Asia because, you know, they don't want what happened before to happen again. So, I mean, I think that's kind of what traders are looking at.
I do have two comments, one on Venezuela and one on Iran and Saudi Arabia. The first one on Venezuela is, we heard the announcement that the Russians are withdrawing their troops. What Russia is doing in Venezuela is exactly what it did in Syria. They are using exactly the same book they used in Syria, and they are flipping page by page. In Syria, they already announced a withdrawal of troops 3 times, but they are still in Syria. I don't think that Putin is going to let Maduro down at all. The second point is about the Saudi OSP increase. I think this is intended to prevent a sell-off of the inventories later on when prices go up. And that's, I think, is an issue, because the Saudis were burnt by the Chinese last year. And the increase now means that the difference between the cost and the future price is smaller, and therefore there is no incentive to liquidate.
At this point, I'd like to move on to a couple of other topics. Anas, you just spoke in China about pricing of oil in U.S. dollars versus Chinese yuan. Well, it's very easy to understand why the Chinese want to institute this change to provide at least one futures contract that's denominated in something other than U.S. dollars. I think the much more important question is, will OPEC be enticed at some point, because they obviously control so much of the market, to abandon their policy of pricing all of their exports in U.S. dollars, regardless of what country they're being set to? So I guess the question on my mind is there any realistic chance of that actually happening anytime soon? And if so, what would the consequences be? Anna, since you have the most access to Saudi Arabia, why don't you give us your perspective first before we move on?
Well, here is the issue, Eric. We have to distinguish between pricing oil in dollar versus getting revenues in other currencies. Oil is priced in dollar regardless and will continue to be priced in dollar. So whether those governments want to receive their revenues in yuan or other currencies, that's possible at any moment. But pricing will continue to be in US dollar. In fact, one of the most important long-term impact of the share revolution is that the US is guaranteeing that oil will be priced in dollar in the future, even with a weaker US militarily or politically. Since you mentioned this, I will send some slides to be posted along with the program on this. Here is why. Because if you look at oil prices at UN denominated oil prices, and you compare that to dollar pricing, you'll find two results. The first one is it's highly correlated with Dubai. That's number one. And second, if you adjust for exchange rates and you adjust for time zones, the correlation is almost perfect. That tells two stories. The first story is that oil remains priced in dollar because that's where the source of the pricing in UN is coming from. And it shows that part of the success of this contract in China, basically, is letting everything priced in dollar and just let the exchange rates and the time zones play. Among the 16 contracts that we launched historically, only two succeeded outside the United States and Europe, and that's the DME of Dubai and the INE in Shanghai. So there is no way we are going to find a way right now to price oil in non-dollar, but countries are free to get their money in any currency.
Tracy Shukart, what's your take on this issue?
I think I'm fairly vocal on Twitter about it. I 100% agree. I mean, oil will be priced in dollar. It doesn't matter what currency you settle in. If you choose to, you know, you could settle in whatever currency you want, you're going to have an exchange rate problem. That's all that's going to happen. Secondly, if we want to talk about this China oil contract, if we take a look at this, all of the volume is in the front month, meaning it's a completely spec product. And a friend of mine just got back from Shanghai and basically talked to the Shanghai exchange, and they said it's a contract for, you know, it's contract for locals and, you know, the Chinese, basically foreigners are not trading this product. So I don't think that it's going to move the needle in any way against any of the other exchanges that are priced in dollar.
Tracy and Anas, I just want to push back a little bit because I couldn't agree with you more that price discovery occurs in U.S. dollars. That's the way everybody's used to thinking, and I don't see that changing anytime soon. But if I kind of psychologically channel Luke Grohman here, who's not with us, I think what he would say is, wait a minute, guys, it makes a big difference what currency you're settling in, because when the trade is in U.S. dollars and settled in U.S. dollars, that means the exporting nation ends up with U.S. dollars that they usually spend on U.S. Treasury bills. And we've got the whole petrodollar recycling system, which enables the United States to get away with its deficit spending, because there's this endless demand for Treasury paper to do something with those U.S. dollars that the oil producers have coming in. If the settlement is in euros or in yuan or in some other currency, I agree with you that the price discovery is still occurring in dollars. But that means that the settlement, if it's in euros, say, that means that they are going to be buying European sovereign debt instead of U.S. treasuries. Isn't that a game changer in terms of the foreign relations aspect of the exporting nation's relationship with the United States?
The issue here is this, that the trade of the Gulf nations, that Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, UAE, Bahrain, Oman, etc., with China, increased substantially in the last 15 years. And any amount of oil they sell to China, basically, is going to barely cover their trade with China. So the idea that is going to go to U.S. Treasury is just nonsense in this case, because they have trade with China and they can cover the currency in this case with China. Now, China basically is going to launch more contracts, by the way, on commodities and resources, including agricultural products. So probably there will be more trade in their own currency. The idea that they are going to use yuan basically to buy treasuries in China or use any other currency to buy it from Europe is nonsense, because it barely covers their trade with those countries. So with China, their sales to China barely cover their trade with China, because they are importing more and more.
So your belief then, Ennis, is that whatever the net profit is after any trade considerations, they're just going to convert those yuan or euros or whatever they're being paid in back into U.S. dollars and buy treasuries with them?
Not necessarily. I mean, this idea that they have to buy treasuries is a complete nonsense. Let me say one comment here, because all of this is stemming from a conspiracy idea that started in 1974. Many people believe that after the U.S. basically moved out of the gold standard, that they have this secret pact with Saudi Arabia to sell oil in dollar. Here is the problem. Oil being sold in dollar decades before that. It's been priced in dollar decades before that. The Seven Sisters basically traded in dollar without any problems before that. The issue here is this, that I strongly believe that even if you have a conspiracy theory, but you have a different outcomes, and you always, with any scenario, you end up with the same outcome of the conspiracy theory, then the conspiracy theory is irrelevant. Because those countries had no other choice but to price their oil in dollar. They looked at SDR, they looked at basket of currencies, and among all the choices, the final choice was dollar. So whether you add conspiracy to it or not, it doesn't matter, because the outcome is the same.
Let's move on to one final topic before we wrap up the show today. OPEC, or OPEC Plus, has a meeting coming up, we think, in the end of June, maybe, or the beginning of July, maybe, or we don't have a date yet. We're not sure. Ennis, why don't we have a date? What are the possibilities? And what, if anything, are you going to be looking for? Or what do you think the most important issues are that we should be watching for with regard to this upcoming OPEC Plus meeting?
Generally speaking, about 3-4 weeks ago, this meeting was a very detrimental meeting. It was a very important meeting. Right now, it's no longer important. I think the results are already preset. I think OPEC will continue the agreement to the end of the year, although we might hear some noise from the Russians, but I think the results are very clear right now. I think they will continue the agreement to the end of the year. Regarding the date, it seems there is some scheduling conflict. We'll see how it's going to go.
Listeners, we need your help putting the word out that there's a new podcast in town, and we do intend to become the definitive weekly information source for energy traders, investors, and others interested in energy markets. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes or at macrovoices.com, and you'll also gain access to our Thursday night podcast, which has a much more general macroeconomic focus. We're also looking for sponsors so that we can keep all of our Macro Voices content free for the listener. If your company is interested in sponsoring Macro Voices Energy Week or any of our other Macro Voices content, please email me at info@macrovoices.com. Before we close, I want to ask each of our panelists what they're going to be watching for in energy markets in the week ahead. Ennis Alhaji, what have you got your eye on?
Generally speaking, I'm still watching the refinery outages and the comeback of those refineries. I think that's going to make a big difference. The adjustment in the EIA data relative to this week is going to be very important. So I am looking for a draw in storage next week and higher prices.
Tracy Shuchart, what are you looking for in the week ahead?
Same thing Anas is looking for. I mean, we're looking for, you know, I'm really looking to see if the U.S. starts drawing, if refinery throughputs start ramping up again. That'll make a big difference in inventory numbers.
Art Berman, what's on your radar?
I hate to be boring and repetitive, but I'm in the same place that both Honest and Tracy are. This refinery utilization issue is very real, but I'll just point out that it keeps climbing every week. It's way below where it ought to be, but you know, this is becoming, to me at least, less of an issue, or less of a rationalization, put it that way, as to why crude inventories keep climbing. And so I'm going to be watching for information that either pushes me over into the camp that says it's all about outages or it's a lot about outages. Because right now I'm in the camp that I just think that refiners are buying a whole lot less crude oil because they see weak end user demand.
Macro Voices Energy Week is released every Wednesday evening. Next week's panel includes Art Berman, Pat Hemsworth, and Chris Cook. But before we let this week's panel go, I'd like to ask each of you to please tell our listeners where they can follow your work and learn more about what you do. Let's start with artberman.com.
Well, that's it. Artberman.com is my website. At AEBerman12 is my Twitter feed. I'm out on both of them all the time, and I've been, I think, pretty consistent on calling oil and gas prices, so give me a shot.
Anybody who's anybody already knows Tracy Shuchart's Twitter handle is at ShyGirl, C-H-I-G-R-L. Tracy, where else can people follow your work, including your blog?
ShyGirl.com. I haven't really been diligent in keeping it up. Sorry about that. And for right now, I will say that's where you can find me.
And Anas Alhaji.
So people can find me on my website, Anas Alhaji, AnasAlhaji.com, and my Twitter at Anas Alhaji.
Okay. Well, thanks everybody for another fantastic show. For the Macro Voices Podcast Network, I'm Eric Townsend. We'll see you next week, everybody.
This edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Please register your free account at macrovoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly research roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. Also gain access to our free research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts, Eric Townsend, shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices.